It is Tuesday, January 18th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, associate professor of political science at the University of Arkansas, co-author of The Long Southern Strategy, How Chasing White Voters in the South Changed American Politics. We'll be talking to Angie Maxwell. First, Senate Democrats attempt to push a voting rights bill, but they will not shed the filibuster. As such, we're just going to get a show. The Pacific island of Tonga, buried by an undersea volcanic eruption. The exact nature and amount of the damage, we don't know, but it seems less than we had thought. New information on the gunman who held a Texas synagogue hostage and was shot by the FBI. Omicron seems to have peaked in New England. Now on to the rest of the country. Deaths and cases rise in nursing homes. Meanwhile, hospitals hit staffing shortages. Secretary of State Blinken visits Ukraine with a bipartisan team of senators as tensions in Russia mount. With Russia, I should say, mount. Shipments of U.S. government-free COVID tests are going to take a week plus. So order in advance, folks. Prosecutors grant immunity to Matt Gaetz's ex-girlfriend. Presumably, she has information for his sex trafficking and obstruction investigations.
Whoa.
Newly released memo show extreme meddling with the census during the Trump administration. 60 Cubans put on trial for protesting. They face 30 years each. Meanwhile, detainees in an Arkansas jail sue over the jail having given them unknowingly ivermectin. And DirecTV drops One America News. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Joining me, as always, Emma Viglin. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam. Didn't sound too excited about that, huh?
Who didn't?
You, about me joining you.
What are you talking
joining
about?
Joining me, as always.
I didn't do that part.
Yeah, well.
I didn't do the...
Might as well have.
Well, you know, I realized like today's actually sort of a Monday.
Yeah.
And
feels like one.
As soon as I look over to you at on a Monday, I obviously think like, oh, she's all juice from all the football she walked.
I am.
and then I
what'd you drop?
I don't know. I dropped something. But then I realized, like, the Patriots got destroyed, and that was a horrible game.
Yeah.
And so all of that happened in that one fleeting moment.
I made a good amount of money this weekend, so I'm pretty happy about it.
Wow. Well, I'm glad that those apps only came in, like, at the end of the season so that we'll have time to gear up
for the interventions. And I've been honestly on a heater with hockey betting, but that's a whole separate thing.
Separate for now. We'll see.
All right. Well,
we can talk about it later.
Yeah. Maybe we should, actually. human resources might be in touch. Yesterday, of course, was Martin Luther King's birthday, or the day we celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday. And the Biden administration has tried to, with good reason, associate that day with an attempt to reinstate parts of the Voting Rights Act and to expand voting rights and an attempt to keep redistricting from becoming completely off the rails. That vote, I guess, is going to take place today or is going to start. I have read about 14 different iterations of what the Democrats are supposedly could or can or will do to try and circumvent the filibuster. The bottom line is Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin refused to vote for a carve out for the filibuster. I just want to remind you that the last time we had a carve out to the filibuster took place. And now I'm older than many of you, so I remember this. Took place in December of 2020.
Yeah, but Sinema must have not been in favor of that, right?
No, Sinema was, in fact, in favor of it. So wasn't Joe Manchin. Mm. It was a carve-out to raise the debt ceiling. Now, this took place, like I say, all the way a month ago. And so this filibuster is so sacrosanct to Kristen Sinema, to Joe Manchin, that they can't imagine in this era, and by this era, I mean these three weeks, voting to do a carve out of the filibuster for any reason. So that's where we're at.
But luckily, they didn't have the gall to invoke Martin Luther King yesterday for any particular reason, right?
Oh, my
God. Just kidding.
They all did.
They all did, even though the filibuster was explicitly something that MLK opposed.
In fact, here is a clip that has been making the rounds. It was on C-SPAN, tweeted out by Ari Berman. Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., 1963, speaking to reporters at a press conference about that very topic.
If the president's program were incorporated, or such portions of it that would lend themselves to this, how would you feel about submitting this to a vote of the people of the United States who have never really had an opportunity to express themselves in this area?
Well, this will certainly be all right with me, because I think the vast majority of people in the United States would vote favorably for such a bill. I think the tragedy is that we have a Congress with a Senate that has a minority of misguided senators who will use the filibuster to keep the majority of people from even voting. They won't let the majority of senators vote. And certainly they wouldn't want the majority of people to vote, because they know they do not represent the majority of the American people. In fact, they represent in their own states a very small minority.
I mean, here's the thing that happens if Vice President Kamala Harris decides we're no longer going to listen to the advice of the parliamentarian and we're not going to recognize the filibuster. We're going to vote to get rid of it, let's say. Now, I don't know if Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema are on board with that. I don't know, frankly, even you even need actually to even have a vote to not listen to the parliamentarian and just give them the opportunity to vote up or down on this bill. See where it lands with Manchin and Sinema. I'll tell you what happens after that, though. The filibuster, one of the more anti-democratic features of our Senate, aside from the fact that the way it's apportioned, the fact that 40 million people, more people voted for one set of 50 senators than the other set of 50 senators. The filibuster goes away. It goes away for the Democrats. It goes away for the Republicans. And the Republicans are more than likely to have control of the Senate, maybe coming up. And then people are going to be like, well, I wish the Democrats had the ability to filibuster. Filibuster what? They're voting for the tax cuts anyways.
That can all go through reconciliation.
That can go through reconciliation, things like tax cuts. What is the other Republican plan? If they want to pass these laws, let the American public understand the differences between these two parties.
But that's part of why they favor the filibuster, the many reasons that Democrats like Sinema and Manchin do. It cloaks the true nature of their leadership and of what they're doing in the Senate. It allows for this kind of separation and this mystique that favors the powerful.
Yeah, and it provides a cover for Sinema and Manchin, but frankly, the Republicans have a lot more need for a fig leaf.
Exactly.
And which is why, at the end of the day, I say, let's just blow this thing up and blow it in the most egregious way possible so that the Republicans have the exact same justification for not having a filibuster.
And look how long we've been fighting for, like, against this filibuster. I mean, seriously. And it is racist in nature, and that also needs to be articulated as well.
Well, we're going to be talking in just a moment to Angie Maxwell, associate professor of political science at the University of Arkansas, author of The Long Southern Strategy, How Chasing White Voters in the South Changed American Politics, may have something to do with this. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget, we've got our live show in Boston. Got an email from Todd. I purchased 2 tickets for the January 16th show, and since I can't witness the stunning Boston spring weather for May 15th show, I'd like to donate the ticks. Do you ever happen to have a couple of people who've expressed interest? Thanks and love the show. If you are interested in tickets and you cannot afford them for whatever reason, and you're going to be in Boston on May 15th, you can email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com or head into the Discord. Maybe we can use that as a great place for people to meet up and exchange tickets if they want to do that. So check it out there. Also, don't forget, shop.majorityreportradio.com is where you can get your merch. And justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off that. And again, your support is what keeps this show rolling. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. All right, I want to welcome to the program Angie Maxwell, associate professor of political science at the University of Arkansas. She is also the co-author of The Long Southern Strategy, How Chasing White Voters in the South Changed American Politics. Angie, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Thank y'all for having me.
Of course.
Okay, let's start. I have 2 questions I want to ask you simultaneously, but I will hold off on that. and start with just like, let's go back to just what the equilibrium was between the parties as we get into like coming out of the 1940s. We've gone through now 50, 60 years of Jim Crow at that point in this country. Following Reconstruction, we had the radical Republicans who wanted to sort of, you know, who wanted to empower Black people, and actually there was also other progressive things they wanted to do. The empire struck back, as it were. Jim Crow laws, the Supreme Court helped quite a bit in that endeavor to allow more contraction of voting. And one of the dynamics that came out of that was that you had wealthy plantation owners, Southern aristocrats, were willing to essentially get rid of poor white voters if they could also get rid of Black voters at that time, essentially from the rolls. And so that was so here we are in the 40s. What starts to happen here?
Well, what starts to happen in the 40s is that the National Democratic Party starts shifting in ways that are very counter to the solidly Democratic South, right? The solidly white Democratic South. And so, for example, Truman, integrates the military. He gives a speech at the NAACP where he says, you know, by all Americans, I mean all Americans, and starts pushing, you know, baby steps in kind of progressive civil rights issues. And that absolutely freaks out the white Democrats that had reestablished their power like you described. And so they walk out of the Democratic Convention in 48 and decide to run their own party, the Dixiecrats, thinking that you know, the Democrats can't win without them, right? And this will tell the National Party, you better, you know, you better get back in line. And Truman, of course, wins without them, barely. And so then they're in a kind of, you know, partisan purgatory of sorts, the Southern white Democrats. The National Party is moving away from where they are, but they can't imagine joining the Republican Party, for which there's no infrastructure in the South at all. So in the 50s, walk into the 50s with, you know, both parties wanting Eisenhower to run as their candidate, with almost matching platforms on civil rights and a lot of other issues, no kind of real distinction. And that's when a developing conservative wing of the Republican Party, just a faction, not even the majority of the Republican Party, starts trying to, you know, build a more conservative coalition. And that emerges into what becomes the Southern Strategy, which I call the Long Southern Strategy.
All right. Well, yeah, that brings me up to the other question that I wanted to contemporaneously ask you that I couldn't. What is the difference between the short and the long Southern strategy? I mean, I think people have heard of the Southern strategy and perceive it as a way in which Nixon and through the 80s with Reagan, Atwater sort of, you know, gave up the ghost as he was becoming a ghost, I guess, that there was like an attempt to rile racial animus or to exploit it, I guess, electorally. What do you mean by the long Southern strategy?
Well, for me, like I call it the short Southern strategy, not because it's inaccurate, but just because I feel like it's an incomplete, you know, kind of arc. Most people just think of Nixon and Goldwater. You're already bringing in Reagan, which is an advancement we've made in kind of the way we think about it. But I think it goes even further, and it's on more issues than just race. So when we look at, you know, when we tell the story about how Nixon, you know, wins over some of these, you know, Southern Democrats or wins enough, we kind of go, okay, you know, Republican Party decided to exploit this white racial angst, and boom, the South goes red. Except the South goes completely blue, except for Virginia, back to Jimmy Carter. And then it goes red again to Reagan. And then it's some, you know, five Southern states swing back to Clinton, and more were leaning that way. And then Bush. And so I just kind of wanted to see a more thorough sketching out of what that was. And the real linchpin was looking at the Equal Rights Amendment for women. Because we'd done this, you know, research on the racial issues, and we kind of talked about religion and the GOP's embrace of evangelicals, but there's a bridge between them. And when you look at 1980, Reagan picks up Southern white women in droves because of his decision to drop the Equal Rights Amendment. They polled it, they figured it out, and the data backs it up. And that actually was another part of this kind of Southern strategy. It was exploiting the racial angst, but also the angst about changing gender roles and what that was going to do to life and the family, on top of civil rights changes. I mean, particularly in the South, if you remember, because African-Americans had been kept from, you know, opportunities to advance higher, you know, their degrees, and to get job experience and management and so on. It was actually women going into the workplace after, you know, the Civil Rights Act of 64 that was happening at a much faster rate, because you had women with these degrees and experience. So the gender dynamic was really changing your personal life, like maybe your family or your office, in ways that, you know, integration took a lot longer, right? And so, and then the GOP actually pulled on that and played to that. And that became a bridge, you know, building this connection with the anti-feminists, who were the first to use that banner, family values, was a way that really kind of introduced the GOP to the evangelicals at a different level. So it's kind of the bridge there. So I see that as, just like we talk about the long civil rights movement, the backlash has been longer and more complex to me.
I was excited to read about that, about specifically that aspect in your book, because from my perspective, my theory about how you had people who went from Obama to Trump was more or less, I was okay with the black guy, but I'm not going to have two non-normal presidents in a row. That the idea of a female president, you know, I think from people, yeah, I think people of, you know, from our perspective can see racism and sexism as different animals. But in fact, to the racist sexist, it is just somebody who doesn't look like me.
both counts, you're right, because on one hand, we do find people who express like racial resentment, right, and wouldn't vote for Obama because of it, who actually don't express what we measure as modern sexism, which is not believing that a woman can't do the job. It's resenting a woman that wants to, or distrusting a woman that wants to. It's just feeling uncomfortable with that, which women can also feel, by the way. High numbers of particularly Southern white women express high levels of modern sexism, right? This support for traditional gender roles. And people can hold both of those ideas, racial resentment, modern sexism, and people can have one or the other. And a lot of the people we saw flip from Obama to Clinton, they didn't have a problem with racial resentment, but they absolutely live in a traditional gendered household, right? Or like you said, they were a little bit uncomfortable with both, right? And the combination of two in a row, right? Both of those things are true.
All right. So I want to get to the third sort of leg of this stool. But before we do, this is a good time to just sort of talk about your methodology, because you're making these statements. We should say this is, you did a lot of data mining here. That's what you do. Tell us what you did here and sure. Why, what the data that you compiled was unique in the context of what we've seen in the past in terms of the way that political scientists have approached this stuff.
Yeah, well, thank you for asking that. I'll be as straightforward as I can about it, but most national polls and the ones academics use, the gold standard out of University of Michigan, it's been running since the 50s, has really small samples of the South, really small. And if what Southerners they do have, it's often African-Americans, because they are trying to get a, you know, national sample. And for, you know, generations, the population density was in the South, right? And so realizing that, going back to the raw numbers and all those data sets, we're like, we have to poll a big national poll with an oversample of the South. We've got to have real numbers in the South to be able to look at all this nuance and be able to compare it to the rest of the country.
But why is that gold standard poll do that? Why does it?
That's a great question. It's because they're trying to do is take a national snapshot. That's it. And if they get enough in the South, then they're not going to have enough in the West, and they're not going to have enough here, because it's really expensive to do these deep dive national surveys. They're not a who would you vote for this or this. They're deep, you know, long, extensive work. So it wasn't their job to do. They were trying to take a national snapshot. And we can do a lot of stuff with weighting and statistics, you know, and try to model some things. But when the South was in the middle of a realignment from, you know, blue to red, when the who was voting was changing dramatically, right, after the Voting Rights Act, right, then not having a good, solid, even an oversample of that region that you can compare to the rest of the country, it's just something we haven't had. And so that's what we did.
We should say the importance of that is that's where the story was, right? I mean, that's where all the change was happening in the country. Everything else was sort of moving on in a fairly predictable trajectory. Urban centers are getting more, you know, Democratic. I mean, and you know, maybe rural areas, but the South is where there was real dynamism in terms of how people are changing their voting patterns and what.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And so it was crucial. We also, the other thing we did is we don't just look at geographic South. We also asked, do you identify as Southern? because we find that the South is a, you know, imagined space and a geographic space. Now, political scientists don't usually care about that imagined space because you don't vote where you imagine, you know, to be. But it, identity issues matter in ways that I still think political scientists are teasing out, myself included. And so we were able to compare geographic to Southern identity and that to the national, you know, picture and the non-South. And that is what really kind of opened up some interesting complexity.
So if we're backing up to the origin of this change, really, in the 1940s and the beginning of the long Southern strategy, as you say, I think, do you mind fleshing out a little bit for us why Truman or why the Democratic Party felt that it was in their interest to even make this shift? Because you can, I mean, right, it was the right thing to do, but the cynical part of me is, well, why was there a desire to even move away from having this voting block of racist Southern whites?
You mean why the National Party decided to go in that direction? It's a great question. It's part of it has to do with the New Deal coalition that kind of Truman inherited, which included, you know, African-Americans who could vote, right, with labor, with white Southerners who were traditionally Democrats. So that in that crisis moment, what FDR put together was a bunch of strange bedfellows, right? But it changed kind of the composition of the Democratic Party to a degree. And Truman, you know, very kind of moved by the, you know, Double V campaign, which was the early civil rights movement to say victory at home and victory abroad. Like, we're not going to fight in this military and save the world from Nazism and live under Jim Crow. And Truman was very, you know, convinced by that. And so said, what can I do federally? Well, I can desegregate the military after we won this, you know, war. And so some of it was because that was part of his base now, you know, post that New Deal coalition. So it wasn't crazy. It was just picking one part of the party kind of over the other, you know, to a degree, and kind of hoping change was kind of, hearts and minds are kind of changing too. But Southern, you know, Southern whites, Democrats, you know, for the most part, you know, weren't willing to go there.
Okay. So let's go to the third, tentpole of this long Southern strategy. And it was, you know, it's interesting that you make the point that for those Dixiecrats starting in the 1940s and in the 50s, well, and well into the 60s, there is no Republican infrastructure in the South, and there's no party infrastructure, and there's no institution, there's no way of organizing people. The Democrats at that point had some structure, but they also had unions, which was a big a boon to them. We should say, but not in the South.
But not in the South. That's right.
Not in the South.
That's exactly right.
And so it is, we get this, you know, this response to this broad emancipation, both in terms of race and in terms of gender, and the backlash that comes in there. The third missing piece that comes in the 70s, is religion. And particularly Southern Baptists, you write. Mm-hmm. And with that comes sort of a, almost like an umbrella, like for all of this ideology to roll under, and an infrastructure.
That's right. That's exactly right. And you're so smart to mention the infrastructure part, because when you don't have unions, the biggest institutions in the South are churches, right? So in 1979, the Southern Baptist Convention, there was a fundamentalist takeover. Literally two guys, you know, hatched a plan to say, we don't like how the Baptists are kind of being moderate on some of these changing social issues. And we want a fundamentalist in charge. And if we can campaign and maneuver at the convention, like they had walkie-talkies and stuff, which nobody had done before, we can get our guy, you know, in charge. And then over a decade, that person appoints so many people. Like, there's a committee on committees, you know, which sounds like a nightmare to me. But you point somebody to that and they appoint people. And over a decade, they transform the Southern Baptist Convention, and they, you know, recodify this, you know, wifely doctrine of wifely submission. You know, women must submit to their husbands. And they purge, you know, women from seminary. No more women in seminary. And they build an alliance with the Republican Party. At first, they kind of go to, you know, in early efforts, they had thought maybe they could work with Jimmy Carter, right? But Jimmy Carter didn't do anything that they wanted him to do. So then they kind of build an alliance with Reagan, but they feel like Reagan paid lip service. Then they decide to run their own person. And that didn't work out. And so slowly over time, they started operating like politicos, right? It doesn't matter who the person is. Doesn't matter their background. Doesn't matter if they're Mormon or divorced three times. It matters if they deliver. You know, we look at evangelicals, white evangelicals, particularly in the South, and we think, well, this is so hypocritical, right? These moral values. But that's because we are looking at them as if that's how they're voting, right? They're voting for who will deliver the things they want, no matter what package it is in. So we even polled asking people, you know, if they thought Donald Trump was a Christian. This was back in 2016. They don't, but they voted for him.
Because
they know he's going to deliver the things that they want.
God
and they
works
promise.
In serious ways. I guess.
And it's serious vessels as
let
well.
Let me just back up a little bit in terms of the development of this, and then I want to get into sort of, you know, some of those things that you found in the polling. But one thing I learned from your book, from 1980 to 2000, Southern Baptist ministers, in 1980, 27% of them self-identified as members of the Republican Party. By 2000, 85% did. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. I mean,
that's the story.
That's
right?
It right there. And so now my understanding is, and abortion plays into this, but also, you know, the element of gender, you know, mm-hmm. equality or just the idea of some type of women's liberation, I guess, was, you know, the terminology at that time, at least coming out of the 60s. Bob Jones University, under the and Jimmy Carter, who was a reborn Christian, and like you said, there was some sense that maybe he would be able to motivate them. But at that time, my understanding was in the early 70s, the attitude was leave unto Caesar. That is what is Caesar's. And we don't get political. Bob Jones University was going to have its tax status revoked because it would not allow for a black person to marry a white person. And under, you know, the Civil Rights Act, you're not going to get federal funding. You're not going to get a tax deduction. They knew that was not going to fly in terms of a organizing issue. So they adopted abortion, which of course is really in many respects an extension of just sort of reestablishing the patriarchy. You don't want women to have control over their own bodies and the ability to determine their fate.
You have to remember how many Southern white women supported that, right? So they get organized by the anti-feminist movement, right? Phyllis Schlafly works with Lottie Beth Hobbs of the SBC, of the Southern Baptist Convention, to help organize Southern white women to kill the ERA in their respective states because it was just a few states, you know, shy of ratification. And this galvanized these women, you know, they got them to go to the, you know, convention meetings and to nominate people for their, you know, counter convention they were having. You know, it was a whole, it was the politicizing issue for a whole generation of a lot of Southern white women who also happened to be religious women, right? And saying that the roles that they chose for themselves to be at home, to support their spouse, and there is nothing wrong with that, but it portrayed feminism as not a choice. You know, the anti-feminists told these women, we have these documents, that they would have to work, that they would have to put their babies in government daycare, that if their husband divorced them, there'd be no child support. They told them all these things that terrified these women. Honestly, because there were not, there wasn't an infrastructure for daycare and working and all of this. I mean, that was an overwhelming, you know, kind of feeling. And so they got on church buses and they marched and they organized to kill the ERA. And when you add in abortion and frame it as someone just choosing not to be a mother, right? They took that personally because that is the role that they play and they see as most important. And so you're right, as the two issues kind of collided and you add in also like prayer in schools, right? It became this entire vision of kind of a Christian nationalist. Christians are under attack. You know, we have to protect them. And it was, I'm not saying white Southern men weren't helping with it, but Southern white women are where the shift happens. They're the thing you go, like we talk about suburban women now, they're the thing you go, whoa, okay, that's the shift, right? And we don't write about them. We don't study them. There's no research on them. And it's so critical because, and I say this in this book, but in 2016, when everybody was saying Hillary Clinton lost white women, she actually won white women outside of the South by 4 points. She lost them in the South by 30. And we don't talk about that difference when they say suburban women are leaving outside of the South, right? You look at 2018 and everyone said, look at all these amazing women that won in the midterms, not in the South, right? And there's a cultural reason for that, that has to do with, you know, how gender is perceived by women and men and the choices they make and some of those done it. I know it has to do with party ID too, of course, but it's more than that.
But right? Now you say they happened to be Christian, but isn't that relationship that part of their Christian ID? And you mentioned, you know, people refer to themselves as being Southern without necessarily living in what we consider the South. But there's also data that shows that people consider themselves to be evangelistic Christians without really going to church, and practicing in a manner that would identify them. Now, I mean, I can appreciate that. I don't go to the temple very often. I consider myself a Jew, but it isn't as it doesn't. That ID does not dictate the way I move through the world, I don't think, in the way that it seems that people identify as evangelical, and therefore women have a specific role, men have a specific role, the government has a specific role, race.
That's absolutely
not
right.
Located in that too, right? I mean, this all comes.
It's together. Not based on theology, right? And evangelical used to be, I mean, very much like politics is a worldly concern. That is not a concern we get involved in, right? There was a little bit about communism. There was a little fear about communism in the 40s and 50s, but stayed out of it. And then it becomes, as there's social changes, particularly not as much with race, but with women, this threatened the whole kind of power dynamic in a lot of these. And I mean, this is where you bridge between Catholics and Southern Baptists, right? This is the issue that built this coalition, is on these changing kind of gender roles. And it felt like a real shift and a real threat in a way that hits your everyday life, right? Now if there's women in your workplace and it had been kind of an old boys club, or if you're a woman and a couple of your friends are going to work, and then that's making you feel like, are you not doing enough? And what should you do? And it just really changed the dynamics, and particularly in the South where it had been so traditional. And the churches said, this is going to affect church and God is against it. And they started codifying that, you know, more strictly, and pushing back against it. And that merges very easily into, you know, the issues related to abortion.
Something that doesn't, I think, mesh as easily that they did embrace, though, is the U.S. militarism and kind of intervention abroad, which we're, I mean, we're seeing more acutely now, specifically if it's a Muslim country or something like that.
Such a great point.
How did they, thank you, how did they integrate that? Because that's very helpful for certain powerful actors.
Oh, you're right. And it's similar to what Sam said. It becomes, at that point, when it gets politicized, these attitudes about traditional gender roles and abortion and stuff, it becomes an identity, right? And it becomes a group that feels like they are under attack, right? Even though they're not, we're still a predominantly Christian nation, right? I mean, overwhelmingly, but that it is any minute now, this sense of urgency and crisis. And so then that starts pushing, instead of separation of church and state, like the Southern Baptists kind of fire their lobbyists who were always just making sure they had the free exercise and instead hire a whole group of lobbyists that are pushing for establishment of religion, right? So that's when we start seeing, don't separate church and state. We want Christian nationalists. And that has gone into a whole other place when we start getting the axis of evils language from George W. and to this being a foreign policy kind of vision also. And that is a post 9/11 kind of layer onto this already kind of bent towards Christian nationalism as if you're in this kind of group that identifies this way. And of course, all of the misinformation has, I mean, we didn't used to have this many people who even knew about certain foreign policy conflicts, right? So when you've got that identity group and you've got that infrastructure of the church system and you can access them with information through all these platforms, we're really seeing that aspect of it, you know, tick upward fast.
So can you like just walk us through in terms of a time? Because, you know, you talk about the myth of the gender gap and what that was not so much that women were flocking to the Democratic Party, but rather that white men were flocking to the Republican Party. Is that basically, do I have that right?
Kind of. I mean, it's, so in 1980s, the first time we used the phrase gender gap, and what it technically meant in 1980 was it was just for the Democratic Party, and it was the percentage of women who voted for Carter in 1980 for reelection, minus the percent of men that voted for Carter. And why some feminists really push that is to say, hey, look, women are a bigger base for you. You know, Carter, you know, you got to take us seriously, because they were terrified that the ERA was going to fail and not get extended. I mean, this is really trying to show their importance. It really gets conflated in the media because in 80, because, you know, more women vote for Carter than men vote for Carter, and more women voted overall than men in the election. However, nobody voted for Carter, right? More people voted for Reagan overall. Does that make sense? So yes, within who voted for Carter, but the majority of women voted for Reagan and the majority of men voted for Reagan. And so we kind of conflate like the women's vote, right? Like how women voted with the gender gap, which is just the difference between men and women. And then we try to explain why. Why did more women vote for Carter than men? Well, because they dropped the ERA from their platform in 1980, the Republicans did, after having it for so many years, right? And so there were feminists in the Republican Party that moved to the Democratic Party, and there were men and Southern white women that moved to the Republican Party, and there were African-American women growing in numbers voting that were moving to the Democratic Party too, but it was off, right? People used to say Reagan had a problem with women and getting votes. So his organization polled 40,000 American women to the tune of like $100,000. And they divided them into 64 categories. They called them Nancy's, Helen's, Betty's, whatever. They were trying to understand women in America. And they realized that if they pushed kind of traditional gender roles and Marlboro Man you know, and kind of a traditional first lady, that they win those women they needed to win, right? They lose other ones, but they won, they would win the ones they needed to win in the states they needed to win for an electoral college victory. So that's the other piece of this Southern strategy that's so important, is just to remember the map, right? Republicans looking, it's not just ideology. They're looking at a map going, how do we ever win the presidency? If there's this block, we have to break this up, right? How do, what are some issues that we could maybe pull some voters on? The goal was just to pull a few states at first, right? Because the South had been such a block, right? And so that is why they kind of started pushing and looking at the South, trying to figure out how to appeal there and to constantly appeal there, you know? And so that is why it affects the rest of the country, because ultimately the Republican Party rebranded itself. It nationalized this kind of, as these aspects of Southern white identity, it rebranded itself that way and conservatism that way. And that affects the whole country.
And so was there an increase in the Republican women's vote along these lines, or was it just simply static enough with the addition of men who had maybe abandoned the Democratic Party?
No, Southern white women moved. They moved, and it was, they did move. And there was data that was released that like the week after the election, and there was polling that was actually done on why they moved. And it was, yes, right after 1980. They moved for Reagan because of the equal rights, because the Republican Party dropped the Equal Rights Amendment. That's why. Literally, they asked that question. Literally, they asked the question. And it's why they moved.
And that's why I just want to reiterate this. So when the Republicans dropped the ERA, they got a substantial, I mean, how would you characterize the size of the move of white women to the Republican Party?
Overall, within the vote, when I'm thinking about how many Southern white women actually vote, it's probably an 8 to 10 point move.
That's massive.
It is massive. It's massive.
Is that the story that we...
It's the story we don't tell. It's the story we don't tell.
Okay. And is that the story that we're operating under? I mean, so what happened? So you have, from Reagan, you have this sort of like back and forth a little bit. Now, Bill Clinton, he only wins with 45% of the vote. Maybe it was like 43% or 44%, but he's a Southern governor. And one of the big move that they make with Hillary Clinton over the course of that campaign is she goes from basically saying, you know, I'm not going to stand by my man in the kitchen, more or less, to like, I'm baking cookies by the end of it. Like I think they changed their hairdo. They basically realized at one point, like, oh, we got to appeal to these. We've got to portray you as a Southern woman here.
Some of that was done when she was first lady in Arkansas specifically. And some of those changes were because they were trying to reform education and they couldn't get, you know, people to listen unless someone shows up in a way that they understand and recognize. Right. So some of it was very strategic because there were policy initiatives that they cared that much about trying, you know, to pass, that they were like, we'll meet you where you are, right? It's always framed kind of like it was deceit, but a lot of it was, I'm going to meet you where you are, kind of in the early days, and it's recognizing, policy. You know, it's fish out of water.
But I guess my point is that what Clinton represented, aside from his corporatism and the way that the Democratic Party moved to the right during that time, but in terms of appealing to the cohort that we're talking about, Southern white women, that was sort of an anomaly, and
slowed
the role and hid, to some extent, obscured what was happening.
This is very true. It's because he was one of them. I mean, this is why the short Southern strategy is so incomplete. I mean, can you imagine? A Southern Democrat running right now, and all of a sudden, you know, some Southern Republicans are like, well, but they're, you know, they're from the South. No, they won't. They won't. You know, it's that entrenched now. It wasn't then. The story is longer. So they would vote for Reagan, but they hadn't changed their party ID, right? Or they still call themselves conservative, or they hadn't changed their party ID because Democrats are still in charge in their state.
Right.
Right. And they can't operate. You know, they're teetering between this national identity and this state identity. And, you know, the Democratic brand wasn't ruined, right, to these Southerners. They had where they weren't done with it. So they're able to kind of go back, and Clinton plays it nice and picks up, you know, four or five Southern states. He was also a member of the Southern Baptist Church, you know. And so he kind of skates a little bit of line. It just picks up enough, right?
And then the aughts, and following 9/11, that all gets basically blown up. I also heard a stat, and I think it was from, I can't remember which of those books. I think it was the one by Sides. I'm not quite sure, that 50% of non-college whites prior to Obama thought the Republican Party was still more pro, was more pro, I guess, black people than the Democrats, and that Obama flipped was the final sort of like, I guess, wake up call for these people. That there was just not, there was still the vestige of the Democrats being more hostile to black people than the Republicans. And
well, that's the history for most.
Right.
You know, for most people, I mean, the state I'm in, Arkansas, doesn't flip red till 2012. This is not old kind of history. And part of, you know, what's sometimes hard for people to understand is in some of these homogenous kind of enclaves within the South, you know, the idea that you'd have a black president, I mean, they just didn't believe that was possible. They didn't even like take it seriously. Like over a military guy like John McCain, and they didn't even take it seriously. So it was an alarm. It was a shock to see. And, you know, anybody else that's watching it and paying attention, you know, is like, well, yeah, it's definitely leaning Obama's way. Right. But it did not feel that way, you know, to some of these folks who've never seen, you know, a black political leader at any level, just like when the Supreme Court comes down and rules in favor of gay marriage and legalizes it, you know, that shocked, you know, people that live under what I call this, these kind of sacred canopies where a lot of other outside ideas just kind of don't get in. And so it seems like that is fringe, right? And then when it happens at the national level, all of a sudden, it's very jarring. And we saw a huge backlash for people that kind of live in those really like-minded kind of homogenous communities, which there are many pockets, is particularly in rural places, you know, in the South, where the ideas just don't get in.
And is that backlash in terms of the people who are voting, like in terms of the extra people who are showing up, is that Southern women,
definitely we've seen Southern women's, you know, voting go, you know, continue to go up. But, you know, the voter turnout in the South, unless it's in a competitive state, is still really bad, right? Like, I mean, I think Arkansas was 50th in 2016. You know, you're going to see a high turnout in Texas, Georgia, North Carolina, Florida, because you got competition. When you have one party control, that's just, you know, political science kind of 101. It just doesn't kind of drive turnout. But I guess what I'm trying to say is the identity, the whole brand, this whole new brand of kind of the Republican Party that it, you know, created in order to break up this Southern Democratic bloc, you know. And by the way, there were, and I want to say this, it's important, there with each of these kind of turns the Republican Party took on race, on gender roles, on religion, there were Republicans that absolutely thought it was a terrible idea and hated it. There was factions in the party going, this is a disaster. We don't want to do this. And there were candidates that wouldn't do it. John McCain wouldn't play that card very hard. Neither did Bob Dole, right? Gerald Ford wouldn't. Problem is, they all lost, right? And Mitt Romney. And so playing to that kind of new Southern base on those that reaches people all over the country on those kind of three key issues, you know, that accounts for kind of 95% of Trump's, you know, white vote is being kind of a Christian nationalist or expressing racial resentment or modern sexism. And that's from what people say about themselves. Questions they answer about themselves voluntarily.
And, right? And we can say you did, this is, these are polls that you took in 2012, 2011,
2010, 2012, 2016.
2016. Mm-hmm. And, if I was to go back and read Kevin Phillips's, the emerging, mm-hmm. Republican majority, is that basically the blueprint? Or I think he would have argued.
It's the blueprint on the racial part. That's another important thing to mention is that, you know, when I say the long Southern strategy, there's no one architect that like drafted this whole thing, right? It starts on the racial issue, but then they realize and the Republicans are better at it than Democrats. Let's figure out where the cultural kind of cleavages are, like what gets inside people. And they pay attention to that before they're even horse race polling people. That's how they figure out. They're getting these church, you know, Southern white church women on buses to go follow Schlapp. Like, what is this? Right. They're getting organized. Like, we got to talk to that group. You know, they kind of figure that out. And so, but Kevin Phillips is the one that starts it by saying these people are going to be mad as civil rights changes are enacted and it's happening in their, you know, kind of daily lives. And the National Party has really, Democratic Party has sealed its fate in supporting that. And there's about to be this huge, you know, kind of gap. And if we go build something there, right?
And Phillips famously said, like, you know, find out who they hate.
And that's right. Us versus them. They also learned that from George Wallace. I mean, George Wallace was notorious as the segregationist governor of Alabama who ran three times for the presidency. He called it, you know, it's described about Wallace's positive polarization. So if you can't make people like you, you say, yeah, but you want to be one of those people, right? Are you for us or are you against us? So for Wallace, you know, he's kind of a slimy guy. Some people were just like, eh. But he said, you want to be one of these pinhead liberal intellectual, you know, hippie, long-haired, you know, not patriotic. And people are like, well, I'm definitely not that. So I guess I'm with Wallace. Like right. The us versus them, you know, you're either on this side or you're on this side and a middle that cannot hold. And it's identity based, identity, identity, identity based.
And this identity thing, we didn't get into the grand bargain. I skipped over that. But the grand bargain was essentially we're going to immiserate you economically, poor white guy. But the good news is, you're not going to be as bad as the poor black guy.
And, that's right.
And that was the grand bargain that Lillian Smith wrote about in those, the first half of this, the 20th century.
That's right. I mean, this is how, I mean, whenever you see a power dynamic where the group that controls things in the South is such a small group, right? Such a small group. And yet even in the Civil War, they get all of these people to march to their death who don't even own slaves. For the idea that at least they aren't one, right? It's like poor white Southerners have long been conditioned to kind of forfeit a personal battle, you know, in the service of winning an imagined war from which they do not benefit. And that continues, you know, saying you're with us, you're one of us, has a currency to it of some sort that's kind of intangible, but makes people feel good. And they will value that over an economic interest that honestly they never see changing. That's the other part we miss.
Right.
They don't look at government and think it's going to make a damn bit of difference, right? If you got a $10,000 deductible on that new healthcare plan, it might as well be 10 million, right? And so then they kind of give up on that. And what feels good is feeling like you're part of something, right? And kind of punching at the other guy. You know, that is something that is, they can feel, see, hear, and feel like they belong to and punch back with a little bit of their frustration when they don't see government programs that are going to do anything.
So is that, to the extent that you've seen in the enormous amount of data you've done with this in terms of women in the South and the South in general? Because it's increasingly clear that Democrats, at least on a national level, are not going to be able to maintain any type of like governing majority under the way that we elect people now, mm-hmm. frankly, unless they start to chip away at elements in the South.
Right.
And so is the only that last part that you just mentioned, the idea that the Southerners you looked at in this data do not believe that it's going to make a difference to them on an economic level about the government. The only thing they see a difference is like, you know, who's going to get the goodies? And I want it to still be people like me, essentially. Is the only way to make inroads in there to change their perspective on whether government's ultimately going to be able to deliver to them, which you would need to do? Like, it's a chicken and egg thing on some level.
Deliverables are a critical piece of it. The other piece of it is knowing what those people value. You know, my first book before this one's on the Southern inferiority complex. I'm going to tell you right now, if you went to Southern white women, particularly those who are moms, and you said, you know, you kept schools running, you keep schools running, you volunteer, you do all this stuff that we don't pay you anything to do, you keep schools going, and you did so much work if you were closed and you were working with kids at virtual schooling, you know, we need to you know, people who volunteer at these schools and fill all these jobs have an earned tax credit. Guess what? Those women are like, wow, I'm valued. I can contribute to my family in some way.
They just got that. I mean, it just ended.
But I mean, for the women particularly who volunteer kind of at the schools, I mean, that's why they're going after the school boards with the anti-CRT and all of that, is because those women that are often stay at home, perhaps more affluent, and who have been ones that didn't vote, didn't really participate, right? And, you know, making them feel attacked will drive them to the polls, right? Making them feel valued and respected is a way to perhaps, you know, entice them in a different direction.
And I guess the real good question is like, how do you do that when the framing of what's going on is done much better by the Republicans? I mean, those women did in fact get an extra $300 per kid over the past 6 months or whatever it was, 8 months. It's now expired. And there was an expanded, but it wasn't, nobody was saying like, we're going to get you this because
they weren't saying it because we're going to get you this because so many of you did so much labor during this pandemic. You got your parents shot. You got your, you know, you worked on your kids' school stuff with them. You volunteered at school. You've been under, you know, caregivers like this have been, you know, left out of the conversation. They didn't tell them why.
So it
matters.
And that's not necessarily negated by going to other groups of people and saying the same thing. As long as you say it, I mean, it's just sort of, I guess, like, I don't know, how do you make people around the office feel appreciated? There's your.
You'd be amazed how important it is. Important it is. I mean, what Stacey Abrams did in Georgia, she found the psychological thing. I mean, this is my opinion. She found the psychological thing that was holding Black voters from, you know, back from participating, which is they're going to show up and they're going to have done something wrong and somebody's going to humiliate them, or it's not going to be safe, or they're going to be put, you know, turned away, and they're going to be so angry that they're not going to be able to handle that emotional constraint. And she said, here's the number. They mess with you, you call us. We have your back. We will make sure you do it right. We will help you if somebody mistreats you. It is going to count this time. We will not let it not. Of course, they registered lots of people too, but it was the psychological that says, I'm checking out of voting because I've been treated so badly historically, and I just don't want to feel that way again, right? And it doesn't matter. My vote, not going to change anything. And going in and saying, you know, we're not going to let anybody do that to you. It's going to be a fulfilling experience that goes well. And if we got to stand in line, we're going to stand in line. We are not. It's that you know, that's what she figured out. And that's what those organizations did, is they made people feel empowered. You know, it's not always just the policy. It's the message.
And so is the answer as to like how you start to make inroads in places like North Carolina, in Georgia, and maybe, I don't know, maybe there's one or two other states where you could start to make some inroads, maybe
Texas,
maybe Florida, although Florida seems to be long gone at this point,
there's no one size fits all.
Okay. It's really just got to be, people have to be, and part of the problem is the Democratic Party now finds itself without any infrastructure in most of these states. And so they don't have people there.
And it's worse because of the Voting Rights Act, because we haven't passed that. Like in Arkansas, you know, the work that has gone in for 10 years to where in 2020, but an African-American woman who pulled over 40% in a congressional district, pulled in a ton of money and got really close, and probably would have been even closer if it weren't for all the COVID voting stuff and the absentee ballot mess and all of that. And they just split Little Rock into three separate congressional districts. There are only four in the state. There are only four. And now Little Rock's carved into three. Now, when is that going to change the outcome? No, it was red in before and it's going to be red again. But what it did is it just erased all of those years of building to getting to a place, right? That is the problem. It's not just what's going to happen in 2022. It's all of that erasure. All those people have been working to build that infrastructure, right? That is what I am concerned about. And I don't think people realize that we're about to have the first election cycle in half a century in which the districts have been drawn without any protection.
Without any voting rights protection.
Any protection.
Right.
Yep.
Let's see. Looking
but we can't change what we don't acknowledge. Like we have to recognize what it is. And we have to realize how important it is. And people have to understand the role the South plays nationally, right? Republican primaries, because the Republican National Convention gives bonus delegates to the states that went red in the last election cycle. And because most Southern states are winner take all or winner take most in the Republican primaries, and because a lot of them hold it early, right, in the calendar, the South's influence on that nomination is way larger than its actual size and scope, right? It's over kind of represented. Who they want will be the nominee. On the Democratic side, because those Southern primaries are early, right? And because even though those states are not going to go blue in a general, they are often pragmatists in the sense that, you know, Southern Democrats they did not go for Bernie, right? And it's not necessarily because they don't think Medicare for All is great. They think it's just pie in the sky. They live in a world, in a state, we're in a red state, where that's just inconceivable. That is such a bridge too far. Like they're barely being able to expand Medicaid, right? So they end up, it's not that they are moderates. They're pragmatists, right? They are looking for that balance because they're blue in a red state, in such a red state.
So does that
So it has an influence on who, if you have a crowded field, has an influence on who gets nominated.
And does that have, and we should say, there was a similar dynamic with Obama. Black voters did not believe that Obama could win, and it wasn't until he won Iowa that all of a sudden the polls just dramatically shifted because they just thought it was not possible. But does that mean that there is a feedback loop that comes from front-loading the Democratic primaries that inhibits the ability of the Democratic Party to end up having a coalition that will end up providing the material benefits back to the people that could maybe shift their...
Yes, the feedback loop is a huge problem, and Democrats not recognizing that most people, I think it's 38 states, are under one-party government right now. 38. It's either all red or all blue in your state, for your governor and state legislatures, right? If you are blue living in a red state, it just changes. It's the feedback loop, but it changes what you kind of think is possible. and a candidate explaining what can be done at the federal level that might not be able to be done in your state, that kind of messaging never happens in ways that it should happen. You know, you may not have to say that same thing out in California because you've got a good, strong coalition and maybe you can push it even farther. And that's wonderful. But, you know, moderate Democrats that, you know, get beat up by progressives on the left aren't always in disagreement with the goal. They're just all the way over here at the starting line, you know, and they really have seen, you know, the kind of Republican state leadership carve away at every possible, you know, we're going to sue against federal mandates on vaccines, state. You know, they just see them get in the way all the time. So they don't quite believe sometimes that kind of dream. It's not sold to them in a way that here's the three things we can do your state can't touch, right? We can do this, this, this. Here's what we can work with your state on. We might be able to find a way here, you know, and just recognize that if you're, that there's a very big difference between a blue living in a blue state and a blue living in a red state. So it's, tailoring that message is critical, and Democrats don't do it.
Arguing to blue voters in a red state that you guys may need to do rear guard stuff here, but we on a national level can circumvent this. And
that's right.
What I'm promising you, so that you're addressing, you're not having to pull back on what you're offering, but you're addressing their skepticism on your ability to do it. And so you're showing them exactly how.
You're showing them exactly how you're going. And you can say, it's okay if, you know, blue voters in California want to go this far. That's fine. We will help them do that at their state level. We will help them with this because they're already here. We know you guys don't even have this.
Right.
You don't even have, you know, you have no unions. You have no, you know, maternity and paternity leave. I mean, you have, so we're going to help you there, right? And here's how we can do it. And just letting, you know, recognizing, I guess, where kind of people come from. Just because people are, you know, more moderate in terms of who they vote for doesn't mean they don't have progressive dreams. They're just, they don't, that's not their reality, you know? And so they're trying to take one step at a time.
Angie Maxwell, Associate Professor of Political Science at University of Arkansas. The book is The Long Southern Strategy, How Chasing White Voters in the South Changed American Politics. You co-wrote that with Todd G. Shields. Thanks so much for your time today. It's fascinating stuff, and hope to talk to you again, maybe as we get closer to
absolutely
these midterms. Really appreciate
it. Thank y'all so much.
Thanks so much.
Really appreciate
it. Matt hung up on our guest. That's a fine how do you do.
Sorry, Angie.
Yeah.
But that was excellent.
Looks like Matt did not learn the lesson about making people feel like they're appreciated.
Tailoring one's messaging, but they're tailoring.
Just want to make that clear that if Angie Maxwell comes from Michigan, that doesn't happen. Comes from the Northeast, that doesn't happen. Pacific Northwest, but Arkansas.
Yeah.
Folks, we're going to head into the fun half. I wish I could say, like, well, the good news is the Democratic Party is actually doing X, Y, Z that would address that. And no, they're not.
I mean, they won't even fund. That's something else we could have gotten into it with her about. There's barely any infrastructure or funding for Democratic Party resources in red states.
Exactly. If only Howard Dean had finished, had been given the opportunity for this 50 state strategy. But
yeah, well,
I mean, the Democratic Party in North Dakota acts like resentful that they even have to run a Senate candidate. Like the last time they ran somebody, just some old guy I'd never heard of. He's like, I guess I'll run. The party asked me to, and he got washed by a Republican. And that's like, people think North Dakota has been red forever. No, in my lifetime, for the first, like, until I was a teenager, it was basically the congressperson was a Democrat and both senators were Democrats. And the party just, it's a dying party. It looks like.
So we head into the fun half. Joining us will be Naomi Konst. She is going to join. She's going to hop on right now. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Maybe we should get up and just figure out which state we're going to move to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I want to go somewhere warm if I have a second chance.
Second chance?
Yeah, life. I have too many roots here at this point. But if I'm reincarnated, just bring me to a beach. God, I love it.
Well, I mean, you wait long enough, maybe the beach comes to us. That's the shot.
I am playing the long
change.
Game.
Yeah. Hi, Naomi.
I don't know what just happened, but I loved the end of that conversation just now. Gloom and doom.
We just had a great conversation with the author of The Long Southern Strategy, and she had done massive, massive data dives into Southern women. Mm. And her perspective is that this is the untold story of really what is, you know, and this is all work they did in 2010, 2012, 2016. It was a book that came out in 2019, but it really is about the long Southern strategy that was a sort of race, gender, religion.
Like Phyllis Schlafly, you know.
Exactly.
Aligned, yeah. Yeah.
Anita Bryant. People forget Anita Bryant.
That's a great pitch. Can I do a really quick pitch? Because I think this is related, because we have our own little strategy, if it's okay. Just, it was a great segue. So passing to me for a second. So Matriarch, which is an organization that supports working class women running for office from school board to Congress, is doing a national training, digital, for free. That's not common. On January 29th, it's a full day. It's a campaign training for candidates and their staff, their senior staff. People are thinking about running for office, are running for office, are in office, with a heavy emphasis on folks who are going to be running or thinking about running against Proud Boys and QAnon supporters at the local level. We know that they are putting a lot of money into that right now, and the way that we think that we can combat this is just getting as many working class women to run for office at the local level, because they are scared to death of women. It's clear.
We will put a link to that. If you send it to Bradley, we'll put a link to that in the podcast description. Awesome. And on the YouTube description. And with that said, let me also just read this email I got from Dylan, who's from Central Mass. He was running the Worcester Bernie office with his wife. I wonder if I met Dylan. John Benjamin and I were up there over the primary. I listened to Naomi Kahn speak with Ben Dixon today about the organizing prowess of the Republicans led by Steve Bannon. I want to reach out and tell you that I am helping organize a lot of similar grassroots organizing, but through a left lens. I live in the most conservative rural part of Deep Blue, Massachusetts. I am familiar with where he lives. The wackos are organizing. That's why I won't say specifically where he lives. I've never seen anything like it. Would you like to talk to me about the effort sometime? I'd like to put together a group of folks from across the country who are working on similar efforts. I'm focused on small towns as opposed to cities with the robust Democratic presence and rural regional school committees. Does this sound interesting? Yes. And my suggestion, when folks have things like this, head to our Discord. It is the best way to get in touch and put it out there. That way it exists on the Discord and people can bump into it maybe a couple days later, a week later, and people on the Discord talk. And if somebody says, I'm thinking about doing this, then, you know, this is the way that people organize across, you know, outside of their local spaces. This is the way local spaces organize with other local spaces. Mm-hmm. And so this is a good place for that. Dylan, head over there. And if you're interested in what Dylan's doing, head over there. And Dylan, if you've got candidates who in your locality who could use some training, or campaign managers could use some training, or you could use some training, check out the link that we'll put in there from Matriarch.
Matriarchtraining.com. And we're partnering with a bunch of different organizations out there that have been doing this work for years and years. I mean, the biggest issue is we just realized the infrastructure, the progressive infrastructure, is just not there yet compared to the amount of work that they're doing. But with that being said, running for Congress is great. It's also very expensive. If you want to run for something and you want to run against, I mean, I'm my mindset is the Nazis are here and like, we got to run against them. Bad Democrats are bad and we need better Democrats, but we also need to take these guys on, and they're running in races that are much more. It is not a sophisticated, you don't have to have a sophisticated of an operation to run for
lower bar entry, as it were.
Exactly. That's a better way of saying it. Exactly. That's why you're the boss, Sam. You have a more sophisticated vocabulary than I do.
Lower bar to entry. I just borrowed that from the whole business thing.
He is the boss, but he's not a boss.
Like Springsteen.
No.
Got it. No,
you're like a boss is you're cool. The boss.
I know the lingo. Boss. Believe me, I'm aware of the lingo. Oh yeah,
thus proving my point.
Yes,
now with the new look, your boss.
With the new look, right? Exactly.
Have you seen this yet? Oh well, I guess you did. You were on the show when I wasn't here in the first year of.
Did you see my beard before? You saw it.
Oh yeah, no, I commented when people said it was new. I said no.
Beard has its own spin-off show. But before we get to that, Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian Media universe?
We got Ben Burgess on Left Reckoning tomorrow night to talk about his Christopher Hitchens book. Also, check out my John Milton episode on free speech, Areopagitica. That's Literary Hangover, patreon.com/literaryhangover.
All right, we're going to head into the fun half of the program, ladies and gentlemen. Don't know if we'll take phone calls, but we will definitely take your IMs. You can IM us through the app, which you can get for free at majorityapp.com. See you there.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.